Hey, everybody, meet Troy Dannon. I told you it'd be a friendly crowd.
You know, when I walked in the door, my back pocket started vibrating. I think my credit card had this sense that it was someplace familiar.
Well, that's kind of the insidious trick. We make you come to us because maybe you have to buy something on your way out. So that's
exactly
how this works.
I knew there was a hook.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Nordy Pod. I'm Pete Nordstrom, president of Nordstrom, and your host for this podcast. Join me as I take you on an honest, authentic journey through our company and introduce you to many of the fascinating people in my life, one episode at a time. For this episode, I'm super excited to share my conversations with two really incredible people in the world of sports. First, you'll hear a special live recording of my chat with the new athletic director at the University of Washington, Troy Dannon.
Part of the problem, we have scoreboards that define success for a lot of people. Gravestones are actually where our success is going to be. You know, I tell our coaches that what you do will be appreciated after you die by the kids that you coached, and they understand that they're in a better place in life because of what you taught them.
After that, you'll hear from former Nordstrom employee and the founder and CEO of All In Sport Consulting, Donna Callahan.
One thing to know about the disability community is we're loyal. We know that we can always go to the places that worked for us in the past, and Nordstrom has been that organization that I've always felt equal and welcome.
These two leaders share loads of great wisdom for anyone listening, and I'm glad for the opportunity to highlight their hard work and positive impact on the world. So let's get into it. Okay, so to give you a little more context on my conversation with Troy, we recorded this thing live at a recent Nordstrom leadership meeting in front of a whole audience of our executive leadership team. And although Troy's not a retailer, we invited him out to share his story because he's had a lot of great experience managing large groups of people in really complex and high-stakes situations. In his career, Troy's been the athletic director at three different schools: the University of Northern Iowa, Tulane University in Louisiana, and currently here in Seattle at the University of Washington. I'm super grateful that Troy took the time to come out here and get up on stage with me. I think there's a lot of crossover application between what Troy does as an athletic director and, frankly, any business. And I know our team gained a lot of really valuable insights from listening to Troy's story. But I also just like talking about sports, too. So let's talk about sports. So Troy has been gracious enough to join us. We talked a little bit about the preamble to how that all happened, but Troy is the athletic director at the University of Washington and has had the job literally for 5 months, and it's been action-packed, and we're going to get into that. But I think probably the best way to start is for Troy to talk a little bit about his background and his journey that brought him to that job, because it's a big job. It's not easy to get, and there's a journey to get there for sure.
Yeah, and I have a very atypical journey for the world of college athletics. This is a very transient world. Most people will be at 8-10 stops as they move up their career, and I actually, this is my third job. My first, I'm an Iowan. Grew up, lived in Iowa my entire life, so did my wife. Worked for after college. I went to Northern Iowa. That was my alma mater. After college, I went to work for the State High School Athletic Association. And in Iowa, there's one for girls, one for boys. And I worked for and eventually ran the one for girls. I was there 18 years. And the AD job at my alma mater opened up. And I got back to Northern Iowa. And it was a pretty cool thing because, you know, there's a sense of ownership, right, when it's yours. It's your alma mater. And so you look at it differently. It's not just a job. And at some point in time, I started getting recruited, which is kind of nice. Ooh.
Okay, so let's back up for a second. So you got to Northern Iowa. It's your first AD job. And then obviously you get recruited because you have success.
Yeah, we had, in fact, a couple of my best Seattle stories or Northern Iowa stories. One, we went to the Sweet 16 in basketball. We were Cinderella one year. Had a kid, Ali Farouk Manesh, if you remember, beat Kansas on his three-pointer, and we were that team during the basketball tournament. And then
the bracket buster.
We were. Yeah. And then 2015, we played here. It was still Key Arena. And we were 30-win team, and a path had been carved out for us to be the favorite to get to the Final Four out of the region. And we lost. We won the first game here, and then our shooter got a broken finger and couldn't shoot in the last game here, and we lost. So that was my lasting memory of Seattle, was losing with a clear path to the Final
Sorry
Four.
Sorry about that.
Oh, yeah, when I was in Northern Ireland. But we had really good volleyball. We were top 10 volleyball team in the country five or six times, and really good across the board. The stratification in college athletics is getting worse and worse and worse. At Northern Iowa, we could compete at the time financially, but you know, all of a sudden we couldn't really compete.
So give us an idea what your budget was in Northern Iowa in the last
14 million dollars.
$14 million a year.
Yep. Versus it's 160 right now at Washington. So we got a lot done for 14 million. We got a lot done.
I bet.
And now the ironic thing is the budget in Northern Iowa is still $14 million. And I left in 2015.
Talk about that. So you went to Tulane. Yeah, so how did that happen? You were being recruited?
Yeah, got recruited. I'd been recruited a couple other jobs. And you know, in my world, you move up according to football. And I wanted to go to a school with a little bigger football. So Tulane had it. Now, Tulane, ironically enough, it's an incredible academic institution, you know, top 30 in the country. Living in New Orleans when you lived in Iowa your whole life was a bit of a transition, to say the least. And it was also probably one of the three or four worst football programs in the country. And so there was an immense challenge along with it. I hired a football coach 6 days in. My last interview there, they said, we want you to come prepared. We're going to fire the football coach the day before your last interview. We want you to come prepared to talk about what you will do to hire a new football coach.
You said, I got this guy at Northern Iowa who's really good.
I said, I've never lived outside the state. I'm coming to the Deep South. I'm at a regional public school that if you apply, you get in, versus Tulane that's got a 9% acceptance rate. You know, so it's a whole different school. So I knew who I wanted as a coach, and I came in and I advertised him not by name, but by characteristics, and they hired me. And then I was like, doggone, I better be able to get this guy, right? So then I went on a search, a long search by today's standards, right? But 6 days later, I hired their football coach, and he turned it around. And you know, part of it, we'll talk about this with Jed, but when I hired him, it was like, you know, we're gonna be partners in this thing. And that partnership is going to determine how far we go. So he told me what to get out of the way, and then my staff got stuff out of the way. And football got to the point, you know, I think 2 years ago was we beat USC in the Cotton Bowl. Again, it was the moment, right? It was like the Northern Iowa moment when we beat Kansas. It was like we beat this Heisman Trophy winner on this most incredible last 5 minutes maybe in college football history. And then all of a sudden, I start getting recruited again. You know, that's how this works. So here we are.
So talk about your 5 months and what just transpired from like literally walking in the door on day one to where you are now.
Honestly, when I joked a lot with Kalen when we got to the Sugar Bowl to the semifinal, I said, you know, Kalen, we're only 5-0 when I got here. Now we're 13-0. I need a little credit here. and I didn't get any. No. But you know, part of my job was staying out of the way. Really good people in place, an incredible culture inside the department. The staff, it's really good staff. So all the pieces
were in place.
So
they didn't bring you in saying it's a reclamation project. You got to get rid of a bunch of people and you got to...
No, they did not say come in and fix it. And my two jobs previously had been fixer-uppers. And on it, I didn't want another fixer-upper. You know, I'm 57. I wanted a place where you could win and win at a really high level. I'd interviewed a couple of times, turned down a lot of other interviews the last couple of years because I didn't think that you could win there. And there's too much time, effort, and energy that goes into this to not be able to win.
So what was it about Washington? I mean, there's a lot of big schools out there, but they're not necessarily winners. So what was it about Washington, whether it's the culture of it or whatever, that you felt like this is a place that would win?
So history is valuable for one reason. It tells you what you can do. It doesn't predict the future, but it tells you what you can do. And the fact that we'd climbed the mountain with two different coaches in the last 30 years, I thought we could continue to climb the mountain. And I knew we were climbing the mountain with Kalen coming in. And if you look at schools like, and I'll pick on Nebraska because I'm from Iowa, right? The schools that used to be on top of the mountain that when they fell down, they have not yet climbed back up the mountain. And so that was a big part of it. History showed it could happen. the move to the Big Ten, and honestly, like if you had offered me this job and we were still in the Pac-12, would I have taken it? Probably. But the Big Ten, you know, you want to be at the table where your future is going to be determined.
So talk a little bit about the excitement of what happened there from October 9th and then going in and playing in the national championship, which, you know, to my point, we were really good. But I think if you'd said on October 9th and we're going to the national championship, that probably would have surprised people.
Well, so that first week, so I was offered the job on Friday, told the family on Saturday, and I was here on Monday and haven't left.
I hope someone packed up your stuff well at home.
Someone packed up my stuff at the office. I am going back to New Orleans this weekend. My family's still not here. It'll be the second time I've been back. The first time was for the Sugar Bowl. So that was fortunate that we got to play the bowl game in New Orleans. But it was Oregon week.
Was your first week.
It was my first week. Game day week was here. So it was, talking about a blur. Yeah. Now, I'm going to go back to why Washington. So, you know, when you grow up, when I was 21, 22, and when, I just graduated college in 89, I guess, so 22, 23, when the 91 team won the national championship. And when you turned on the TV in Iowa, there were three games on a weekend, right? This was the center of the college football universe. Don James was the center of it. And so I grew up and I saw those stands. I saw that purple. Northern Iowa was purple and gold, right? My mom honored. So it was just born into me. And it's like, I just remembered this. And there was always this image and impression of this university because of that. So when it came in, we had the Oregon game and it was nuts in there, right? The 72,000 people and the decibel meter got to just under the record, what it had ever been. And everybody said, I haven't seen it like this in forever. And I said, well, this is kind of what I expected it to be because this is what I'd seen. And so, you know, now my bar is a little high now, right? But yeah. But this is what I thought we could be. I just didn't know it'd be the first week. And everybody said, well, it can't get any better than this. And then it kept getting better and better and better. And we get to the end of the season and you know, hey, we had everything go right for us. I was here those nine games prior to the national championship. You know, every one of them came down to the last possession, and we won every one of them. And so, you know, you've got to have a lot of things happen. We had a generational quarterback. We had great coaching staff. We had like three NFL receivers that will go in the top three rounds. But you still have to have everything go right to have happened what happened. And so it was a neat experience to be a part of.
Yeah. So what I want to do now is transition a little bit to the stuff that it creates the perspective and context that has an application for what we do. And it starts with anytime I contemplate talking to people from sports about business, it's somewhat in the context of sports have become a big business. And so you talk about it relative to the budget and all that. And you've touched on it. But I wonder if you could describe the nature of the job and what has changed and how it's evolved from when you were first at Northern Iowa to now, which is, what, 16 years ago? Because a big theme for us, too, is how much things have changed and hence have become harder.
Well, none of you will have ever seen the movie, and I don't quote movies, North Dallas 40. You have to be really a weird person to have watched that movie as much as I did.
Who are the weird people out there who've seen
raise
that
your
movie?
Hand. North Dallas 40, but there's a line in there where he says, every time I say it's a business, you say it's a game. And this is the dilemma that this whole enterprise is in. This is the difference between Northern Iowa 16 years ago and Washington today. And what lies ahead, we haven't even begun to see the change that we're going to see in the next 3 years. Because there's this, I would say, use these scales, there's a holistic, you know, we're a business inside of higher education. So there's this duality we serve, right? We have the holistic student outcome. And then we have the business model. And every time you make a move here, it tends to affect the business model inversely. And every time, you know, we've done so much with the business model, now we have all the student labor issues and the experience and the revenue sharing and all that come up. So the challenge today that really didn't exist, even when I took the Tulane job in 2015, we didn't talk about name, image, and likeness.
And by the way, so name, image, and likeness, there's a deal called NIL, which is name, image, and likeness, and it has become the vehicle by which now players get paid.
Pay for
where
play.
Yeah. Years ago, if they were getting paid, it was under the table. But now it's all out there, and it's like the wild, wild west.
It is, and name, image, likeness, the ability to transfer and change schools as often as you can, and what happens in the future with labor. There's court cases now, whether the student athletes are employees. you know, whether there needs to be true revenue sharing inside of the athletic department. But yet we're in this business model where there's one sport that cash flows, and that's football. And everything else is a net expense, a significant net expense. And
one basketball pays money.
For the
maybe
other.
Maybe a good school.
Basketball right now does not make money here, but at some places it does.
Yeah.
But again, it's incremental. Most places that make money in basketball, it's less than one football game's worth of net revenue.
So, and that's all about media again? It's not, or is that about attendance? Or what? Give us a breakdown. The
media contracts the Big Ten media contract is going to get north of $50 million.
For football?
Well, in general. Okay. It's assigned by institution. About 90 to 95% of that value is attributed to football. And the rest is attributed to the other sports. So financially, from a ticket standpoint, from a donor standpoint, Shannon Kelly is in the back. Shannon oversees all of our revenue. Oversees about $75 million in revenue from ticket sales and from fundraising. And almost all of that is tied to football. Almost all of it. So the model is so built around, and it's you would never apply this business model to Nordstrom's because Nordstrom's wouldn't survive.
So what do you mean by that?
We have no diversification in our revenue, right? It's all right here.
It's all football?
It's all football. It's not a good business model.
When you're Stanford yeah. and you say we've won more national championships than everyone, and it's been in women's swimming and tennis and crew or something, that is not, that's it, nice.
It's not driving revenue.
It's not driving revenue.
It's not driving revenue. Now, at the same time, here's the challenge I have. I've got to do a lot of things to drive revenue, but if we don't graduate, and if our students have bad experiences, and if they get in trouble, I mean, I joked when I first got spoke at the Boys and Girls Club in town, I said, you know, we can win the national championship, but if our graduation rate slips, I'm going to get fired. Now, that's not true at every place, but it is true at UW, because the one thing we have here is perspective. We haven't lost it. So a lot of places are tainted and lost perspective. So we still have that balanced perspective here, which is, again, why be attracted to the job. But at the same time, you know, I'm spending the vast majority of my day, you know, we have a great staff to make sure the experience is right for our athletes and providing them all the resources they need to walk out of here and be prepared to be successful throughout the rest of their lives. But I'm spending the vast majority of my day trying to figure out how to make the financial model work going forward.
So talk a little bit about the different constituencies that you answer to at a public university like this.
So that's the one downfall from going from Tulane to Washington. Private school is a whole lot different. So here, you know, you are very much a public servant. So constituencies, I have my faculty. My faculty cares a whole lot more if we're winning in the classroom than if we're winning on the field. Our donors, who care a whole lot more. Now, some are wired. Everybody's wired a little different. Everybody wants a different ROI on their investment from a donor standpoint, right? So some want to only care if we win on the field. Some only care if the kids are having a good experience. But bottom line is they want you to win in some way, shape, or form. My most important constituents are the athletes. If I fail them, I'm toast. We're toast.
And how many athletes do you have?
We have about 650
okay.
in the department.
That's a lot. And how many coaches?
We have about
coaches?
300 staff members, which is a pretty high ratio, right? But, you know, we have, when the football coach just changed, there are about 40 positions that go along with football. There's 10 or 11 coaching positions, but everything from nutritionists to strength coaches to analysts to the admin to, we have a general manager now. It's almost like an NFL team managing the salary cap and managing NIL. It's a big operation. But most, you know, my coaches are my constituents. My staff are my constituents. Alums are an important constituency group.
Like, but you haven't even mentioned fans. That's a big constituency group.
It is. It's not the most really? Important, but externally, it's going to determine our fate, our fans. And some of those are interlocked as fans and donors. Yeah. But I will tell you, the fans I hear from are not the donors.
Does that sound familiar to some of us?
Yeah.
Some of our loudest customers might not be our best customers.
There you go.
Sometimes.
It's there's this weird inverse relationship between the more you give, the less you complain. And you know, if somebody donates $250, it's important. And it's important money that they're giving us. But that $250 voice, in my mind, it can't be the same as the $5 million voice. but it's equally important to the $250 donor.
So talk about, I mean, because you've got the constituencies, right? There's government, there's state, there's your, you know, the University of Washington school. But I want to talk a little bit about what it's got to be like to manage 600 18 to 22-year-olds and their parents, essentially, because it's not just the kid, right? So what is...
And their agents.
That has got to, like, take up an immense amount of your day. Just what about my kid?
So I've got a rule. I don't talk to parents unless their child is on the phone at the same time.
And that's just
if they want to call and complain about X, Y, and Z, I say, well, I'll have the call, but your son or your daughter's going to be on the call with us. That shuts almost all of it off because they don't want their son and their daughter hearing what they have to tell me. So I shut it off from that standpoint. Now, the coach, I wouldn't be a coach to save my life. I would love to have Jed's contract. Don't get me wrong. but I would not be a coach to save my life because of, you know, we 16 and 17-year-olds, we're telling them they're God's gift. And they have agents. A lot of these kids have agents now. NIL agents.
Not just their uncle who says, I played a little football when I was in high school. Let me tell you all about it.
It's even worse because a lot of them are their uncles. And okay. Uncle agent is a bad combination. But they, and then when they come to campus, it's like, okay, we almost have to tear you down and start over. And in this era of how easy it is to transfer, and most of these elite kids haven't been told, they've been the best all along their path. From the time they were 10 years old, they were the best. And so maybe not being at the front line starting and maybe having to be told, you know, you need to do this if you want to play here. Not everybody's wired for that. So it is a great challenge. It's a tremendous challenge. The other thing about those 650, I will say this. If every one of us in our, and I know what your business is, but in our world, they come, they're anxious to participate. They want to get better. They want to learn, they're enthused. They go home and they can't wait to get there tomorrow. Imagine what it would be like if all of our constituents were like that. I mean, that's not society. This is a great group. You know, you talk about what the motivations are. You get motivated. I'm more motivated today than I was yesterday because the kids keep coming in and they're still highly motivated. They want to get better and they're expecting you to help them get better. It's kind of a cool thing. So, you know, and our staff. You know, 300 people, a lot of, you know, 22 head coaches, everybody's really motivated to win. And so I would tell you, managing the staff, you don't have to motivate your staff. Our staff is very self-motivated. But managing them and managing the realities and the limitations of what we have when everybody's as driven as they are. You know, it's nice to have people that are driven and motivated, but trying to manage all of them in the context of, let's not forget who our North Star is here, which are the kids. And I say kids, I mean, they're 6'6", 315 pounds, and they're 18 years old, you know, but they are still kids. And I'm going off on a tangent, which Shannon can tell you I like to do. When I was at Tulane, I hired Mike Dunleavy Sr. to be the basketball coach. Wonderful coach. And it didn't work.
Yeah, that didn't work out.
It didn't work.
That surprised me because he was a really good coach.
One of the best basketball minds in the country. But you know what the kids told me afterwards was, you know, I want to go to the coach's house and watch the game. I want the coach to ask me about my girlfriend. I want the coach to know that my mom is sick. So as much as we think of this as a business, it gets back to that holistic part. They're still 18 to 22, and they're still going, a lot of them are a long way from home. They're running into sometimes obstacles that they've never run into in their life before. You know, part of the problem, we have scoreboards that define success for a lot of people. Gravestones are actually where our success is going to be measured. You know, I tell our coaches that what you do will be appreciated after you die by the kids that you coached. And they understand that they're in a better place in life because of what you taught them. And I have my own story. So I was a little high school, right? I had 38 people in my class. All right, so I was a great athlete.
So you got some playing time.
I was a great athlete, right? But it was all relative. So my senior year, I was a baseball player. I became the first base coach that I'd started here forever, right? And they put up some freshman in the lineup, and I was the base coach. And I was mad as all creation of the coach the whole way through. And when I was like 28, 29, I was asked to go, the coach had died, and go speak at his funeral. And I hated the guy, right, when I played for him. But then I realized how much of what I'd become, because my parents got divorced when I was in high school. And then I started looking back. I went to this coach's house when I was really mad at my parents, right? And you start thinking about, what do these people actually do and the influence they have in your lives? And so we try to tell our coaches, you know, that's how what you coach to is for when you die, when people look back and you say, what influence did you have in my life? And like this coach, I bawled, right? I stood in front of people from my high school and bawled when I talked about this coach. But you realize what influence they really have in your lives way down the line.
So for us, you know, culture's a big part of why I think a lot of people in this room are here. They could define it in their own way, but they like the people they work with. They like the culture. There is a paycheck thing, but there's more to it that makes it sticky. So talk about how culture is important in the business you're in.
So we talk about family and athletics, right? We talk about family a lot and for our athletes. There's no one on a college campus. We have 52,000 students at the University of Washington, 650 athletes. There is no one situated on our campus in the way those 650 athletes are. And I'm gonna walk through something real quick. I tell them on recruiting, but they're 168 hours in a week. They'll sleep 7 hours a night, our athletes will. That means there's 119 left in their week. I'll give them a couple hours a day to go eat, go to the bathroom, or take a shower. So now we're down to 105 hours left in the week. Then it's time to go to class, and they're in class 15 hours a week. So you're down to 90 hours left in the week, and they tell you to study 2 hours for every 1 hour you're in class. If anybody in here ever did that, raise your hand because you're lying. The reality is you got to study. And let's just say that it's one for one. So we got 75 hours left in the week, and they haven't played a sport yet. Now it's time to go, let's just say football. It's time to go play football. The NCAA lets them 20 hours a week in which they can practice. All right, so now we're down to 55 hours left in the week. Now there's film, there's weightlifting, there's other things. The average student athlete will tell you it's 40 hours a week at their craft. So now we're down to 30 hours left in the week. 168 at the start, we're down to 30, and we have controlled every one of those hours. We tell them when to eat, we tell them when to sleep. We don't tell them when to go to the bathroom, but we tell them when to go to class, we tell them when to study, we have study tables, we tell them when it's time to practice, and we tell them when it's time for voluntary weightlifting. So they're down to 30 hours left in the week. And the culture of the place, everything else is the same in some way, shape, or form. It's the same between here and any other institution. But the last 30 hours is the culture of the place. It's what defines whether they will enjoy their experience or not. And that's not much time. That's time to go date. That's time to hang around with your friends. That's time to just relax and go have a pizza. That's not much time. And so the culture is built on how well we put people around everybody to support them in that 30 hours.
That's great. Look, I want to thank you for doing this. I think it was really insightful and interesting. You're super gracious and nice to give us your time. And just thanks so much for being part of this.
No, I really appreciate it. This is a great opportunity for me. Everybody says I wouldn't do what you do. I wouldn't do what you do to save my life. Because I've only got 650 athletes I've got to satisfy. The people you have to satisfy and how they're it changes, the paradigm changes to keep them satisfied. Well, I wouldn't do what you have to do. But I really appreciate the chance to be here, Pete.
Great.
Thanks.
Thanks so much. All right. This morning, it is my pleasure to have Donna Callahan on the podcast. And you may ask yourself, well, who's Donna Callahan? And frankly, I just met her myself here before we started talking. But I met Donna's brother at a conference where I was speaking. It was a Washington State Hospital Association, I believe is what it's called. And I was the guest speaker. I was asked by Jeff Spearing, who we've had on the podcast from Seattle Children's Hospital, if I would speak to the group. And I was happy to do it. And afterwards, Donna's brother Darren came up and told me about his sister and that she actually had some experiences with Nordstrom, and we might find it interesting for our podcast. So that is what's brought us to this moment. So Donna, thanks so much for agreeing to be on the podcast.
Of course. Happy to be here.
Okay, so I think probably the best place to start is, why is it that we're talking? What is your Nordstrom connection, and how is it that we're talking about that today?
Yeah, so I am a wheelchair user. I have been since the early 70s as a result of transverse myelitis, which left me with incomplete paralysis.
So what does that mean? So I'm sorry, real quickly, what does that mean when you say incomplete paralysis?
It means that I have sensation, I have movement. It's not a complete break. So if someone's in a car accident and they might have a complete break, my paralysis is kind of spotty.
Okay.
And so I've been a wheelchair user. I grew up in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. I moved to San Francisco to go to graduate school at San Francisco State. And I knew once I landed there in San Francisco, I needed to find a job to supplement rent and income and start to make a living. And I saw a magazine, a catalog that came out from Nordstrom. And in the magazine was some models that were amputees, that were wheelchair users. And I kind of was like, well, if they have models with disabilities, maybe they have employees with disabilities. And so I went to the big store, kind of a flagship store there in the Bay Area in San Francisco at Market and Pell. And I was hired to be an operator there at the store, which one I think is hilarious because I know I sound like I'm 12 years old. So the fact that I was making announcements throughout the entire store.
But you have a very nice, pleasant voice, so I'm sure it was
thank
good.
Thank you. So it was fun. I had a great group of people that I met there. And what I enjoyed about it is kind of being behind the scenes. So I wasn't in one particular department, but I got to know the team and the managers and the staff and all the various departments. So it was kind of an interesting place to be in the hub behind the scenes.
Yeah, I've managed stores before, and it is true, particularly in those days, that the operator booth was almost like kind of the hub of everything because all the information was coming, going, and people came in, went right by the booth typically when you walk into employee entrance. Yeah. And so you're right. You kind of get to know everyone. They know you and they rely on that operator group. That is for sure true. So can you talk about what your experience was like, you know, working for us at that time? And did it all go smoothly? I mean, were we set up to accommodate someone like yourself, or what was that journey like?
You know, when I look back at the time, I thought Nordstrom did an amazing job of welcoming me in, not making me feel separate or different, based basically on the way I get around as a wheelchair user. And as far as accommodations, I didn't have many things that I needed. I came in, I put my headset on like I have on today, and answered the phone and that sort of thing. But I think for me, the biggest part was feeling equal and feeling welcome. I think that was very helpful.
That's amazing. Like, I'm happy to hear that it was a positive experience for you. So talk about as you transition, you know, moving on with your life, then you weren't working at Nordstrom. But how did that experience of working for Nordstrom create a point of connection for you that transitioned into being what you described to me earlier as being a loyal customer?
Yeah. So one thing to know about the disability community is we're loyal. If we find a store, if we find a salesperson, if we find a product, if we find clothing that works for us based on our needs as an amputee or a wheelchair user and not getting mud on our clothes or whatever, we know that we can always go to the places that worked for us in the past, and Nordstrom has been that organization that I've always felt I can go and always treated equally. I always appreciate going to the women's shoe department and knowing that if I needed to, I could get different sizes. My feet are different sizes, so it's helpful to know that that's an option, and that accommodation makes it, we want to be just as stylish and look professional or sporty or whatever look we have on that day. And Nordstrom helps us do that.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about the shoe splitting of shoe sizes thing. If a customer has, usually it's about a size and a half difference. And the fact is, lots and lots of people have maybe a half size difference, but if it's more profound than that, and you know, a pretty serious issue, and again, it's usually about a size and a half, we will essentially split those and sell them for the price of one, so they're not paying for two pair of shoes.
Right.
And it warms my heart to hear you use that as an example, because it's something that we've always done. And the and to your point about the loyalty that that's engendered, I mean, I hear from customers all the time that talk about either they've always known this and they use this service from us, or they just found out about it or are kind of blown away that it's offered to them. But it's created an enormous goodwill, I think, with all kinds of customers. So I'm glad you brought up like that example, and people know that that is something that we do with people that have different size feet.
Yeah, it's good to know that I can go somewhere, depending if it's a sandal and you can see your feet and your toes, and you know, I've got 3 inches left over on the heel. It looks a little silly. So the fact that they're willing to work with me and be flexible and accommodating is super helpful, because we want to look, you know, fashionable. And, you know, that's one thing that growing up, you know, when I did with a disability, you know, you didn't see a lot of children out with disabilities out and about. And my mom and my parents always made sure, you know, at the time I had Granimals. I don't know if you remember Granimals are.
Yeah.
And that it was matching outfits and cute little bows, and, you know, that it wasn't this therapeutic, medical looking outfits. They were always, and that's always been just something I've cared very much about, how I look and how I appear, and which maybe isn't always so positive from a mental standpoint to worry about what other people think of you. But I think it's important for people with disabilities to look professional and have a particular standard when it comes to what they're wearing, and to make and to feel good about what they're wearing.
So maybe you can talk a little bit about your professional life and how you've adopted this ability based on your own personal experiences and your desire to, you know, help people that you're involved with the disability community as a profession. So why don't you talk a little bit about what that's been all about for you?
Yeah. So I've had the honor of working for many national adapted sport organizations, helping people discover sport as someone with a disability. And it's been an amazing ride. I've gotten to work at the United States Olympic and Paralympic Committee and see athletes with all sorts of disabilities up on the podium competing at the highest level in the world. One of my highlights of working in this field is seeing Team USA sled hockey up on the gold medal podium in Vancouver. And then also a friend of ours who's an amputee who lost her leg in the Iraq-Afghanistan war. She, the U.S. women's paratriathlon team, swept the medal stand in Rio de Janeiro in 2016. I mean, it's such an amazing sight and feeling to see the flag, the United States flag, raised 3 times above the podium. It's just so incredibly powerful. But it's a lot of changing the narrative around disability sports since I started my business, All in Sport Consulting, back in 2017. Many times, and a majority of the time, adapted sport organizations and many of the people that are reported to in leadership roles did not have a disability. And I kind of have a problem with that. So my goal was to represent the community I serve. And it's actually been very liberating since starting my business, because for so long I had to fit in leadership's box of what they thought adapted sport movement looked like or what it meant to people. But they don't live the disability life day in and day out. And so when I was started my business, I feel like I've been liberated and free of that box, and I can advocate and lead the movement in a way and help organizations shift the narrative from a charity focus to a business focus. And what I've done is I've created an economic impact study related to adapted sport, that it's not just these cute little disabled kids coming to town to play wheelchair basketball. It's an economic force coming to your community for a wheelchair basketball tournament, for a wheelchair tennis tournament, for a sitting volleyball event, and sport in our country and globally is a big business. And
it
so
sure
until
is.
Adapted sport can start talking in those business terms, we're always going to be considered charity, you know, this narrative that doesn't really reflect how powerful the movement is. And then I've also taken it to a new level of focusing on the spectator experience for disabled fans. Do they have the same experience as someone without a disability going to Levi Stadium, Wrigley Field, whatever that might look like? Because you never know when disability might come into your world. You could have a diagnosis, an injury, an illness, and not to be a Debbie Downer, but when and if that should ever happen, we want to be inclusive of those people that join our community every single day.
Right.
And that it's not sad, that it's not pathetic, and it's not. I teach an undergraduate class called Disabilities in Society, and the kids come away and they're like, I didn't realize people with disabilities weren't always sad. Like, nope, wow. We're not always sad.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, making sure people with disabilities in all sport, either as a spectator or a participant, has an equal experience to be able to participate in sport, whatever that choice might be.
That's amazing. That's great. Look, I mean, it's fun learning about what you do, and you've had this intersection with Nordstrom, and I appreciate you sharing that story with us. And congratulations. I think it's super impressive what you're working on, and you know, all the good things that's doing for the disability community, and frankly for everybody, figuring out how we can all live and work together in a way that, you know, everyone adds value, right? And there's a positive side to that.
Yeah.
Donna, it's been really nice to meet you, and I appreciate so much you being on the podcast today.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. It's lovely to meet you.
Well, that's the show. We're really glad you're with us on this journey, and we hope you keep listening. The easiest way to do that is subscribe to the Nordy Pod wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, please take a minute to give us a like, a share, and a review so other people can find this thing too. For more information about the show, head to nordstrom.com/NordyPodcast or follow us on our Instagram page at the Nordy Pod to stay up to date on new episodes, announcements, and more. We'd also really like to hear about your experience with Nordstrom, so if you have a story about how you've received great service or even bad service, send us an email to nordypodcast@nordstrom.com. You can even give us a call and leave a voicemail, and you may just get a chance to talk to me personally on a future episode of the show. That number is 206-594-0526. So don't be shy, drop us a line and be part of the Nordy Pod. And make sure to tune in next time when I sit down with the Faraday twins, Alex and Mike, and Alex's wife, Carrie, co-founders of the clothing brand Faraday.
It was hand-to-hand combat. You know, we got to sell $1,000 worth of product a day to make it. And we would do anything and everything. I mean,
you wouldn't take price tags off of your clothes. And if somebody said, I liked your shirt, you would literally take it off your back. Like, sold. You want it?
We're selling at like music festivals to people by like the urinal. Like, yeah, you know. Like.
Faraday has a really unique and interesting origin story. And their product has proved itself time and again in our stores. The fact that they work so well together as a family unit is testament to their success as a brand. Don't miss this fascinating conversation next time on the Nordy Pod.